Thank you, first of all, to the organizers for inviting me to speak on biological pathway inference. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe a approach to this problem of combining, in this case, gene expression data. So this is continuously valued abundance of messenger RNA as measured on a gene microarray chip. Combine that with ontological data, which describes something about gene function, in particular the products that are generated or induced by gene expression. Okay, so the standard approaches to bioinformatics and data analysis is to be data-driven. Ignore any kind of functional or biological system type of priors, and then after you've done your analysis, pulled out particular gene factors, let's say, from the data, then you go and try to to validate it or to make some inferences on what's actually going on. What are the functional relationships between these genes, and can you somehow incorporate them into a functional pathway? So we do this simultaneously. So here we're going to simultaneously do clustering, variable selection, and then functional annotation. So I think everybody here has at least some vague notion, at the minimum, of the fact that a gene is a segment of the DNA that codes for protein, and of course, not all of the oligonucleotides on the DNA strands code for proteins, but the genes, in particular, are the ones that biologists understand and can ascribe some sort of function to. These functions, which are primarily production of proteins through the proteasome and the process of translation, are organized into what biologists call pathways. So pathways are sequences of activation of different genes or protein products that lead from one state to another, right? So, a pathway for the inflammatory response starts with some infectious agent or some insult to the immune system, and ends up with production of cytokines that basically induce inflammation. There's a very complicated sequence of gene expression that is associated with that process. So one of the principal problems is the discovery of how these pathways become perturbed or deregulated under, for example, disease states. And the principal fact of the matter is that these functions are not just expressed by a particular gene expression factor, but they're expressed over time and over space. And that's what we're going to talk about in particular in the context of the cellular response to infection. I'm going to show some data later on where we'll be applying these techniques as fusion of expression data and ontological gene ontology data. So this just shows a typical picture that you'll find in this particular case in Nature Reviews in 2005, which describes the molecular biologist's understanding of how a cell responds to infection in terms of protein production. So all of these are proteins. In the nucleus, you have the process of DNA transcription and replication, and that generates proteins that that are located in particular regions within the cell, so close to binding sites, receptor sites, production of cytokines and interferons and so forth. And so there's a very complicated diagram here. Pathways can be characterized as these sequences of events that leads, for example, to cell death, programmed cell death, apoptosis, which is an immune response. So the point, though, is that we want to somehow compress all of this complicated and relatively vague information in this picture to some kind of topological constraint on how, say, two genes can be related or not. So this shows what's called a gene ontology semantic graph, and this captures function of different genes. In particular, it captures one of three gene ontological classifications, which is the cellular location of the protein that's produced by a particular gene. So you have here, for example, in the membrane, cellular membrane versus in the protein complex or in the nucleus down here, you'll have different genes that are associated with this particular location in terms of the proteins that they produce. The larger the circle, the more genes are in that particular functional body for this particular process, this particular pathway, which is the immune response pathway. Okay, so this is the diagram that basically we're going to use to merge with the expression data, the raw expression data. This comes from literature. Gene ontology is a database which collects from different databases that represent experimental and validated results on, in this case, location, cellular location of protein production. We're going to take this semantic description of relations between genes that are attached to a particular component, and we're going to use that to sort of precondition the clustering of the gene expression. That's in a nutshell what we're doing. So this just shows this shows the how it's sort of put together in a more graphic context. We have a gene microarray here with genes that are expressed, say, over different treatments in class one, which might be the healthy, and the class two are the tuberculosis subjects, and then these would be different genes along the rows. And we take these ontological spheres that I showed in the previous slide. So this might be the nucleus. This one might be the cytoplasm. This might be the proteasome. And that then gives like a prior on how closely related these genes are in terms of function. Okay. All right. So going from clusters to functional pathways is a very difficult problem. And the problem is that genes with similar temporal expression do not necessarily have similar function, right? And so if you use correlation to correlate gene expression from two different genes and say that they have the same function just simply because they seem to have the same shape over their temporal expression profile, that may be completely spurious. They may not share function. How do you incorporate function into the as additional information? You use gene ontology. So in order to capture this ontological function relationship between two genes, we're going to use basically a manifold learning embedding type of approach, the Laplace eigenmaps approach, which is going to basically embed the genes into a lower dimensional manifold where distances in that manifold are going to be directly proportional to the ontological similarity between those two genes. So if the genes live in one of the common locations within the cell in terms of the protein production, then this similarity WIJ between the two genes IJ will be large, right? And that will be used as a weighting in this Laplacian eigenmaps clustering procedure, which will give us a lower dimensional Laplacian induced embedding of the data. Okay. Now, where does the gene expression come in? It comes in a very weak sense in this embedding. This embedding, you can look at it as being driven by the ontology. It's being driven by function, so similar functions in this case being similar locations within the cell that these genes operate in. That's our WIJ, but the gene expression controls the neighborhoods. So we are going to basically assign zero weight if the expression profiles are too dissimilar. Okay, so it's a way of conditioning The embedding, which would just be based on pure ontology, based on the similarity of the gene expression profiles. I'm not going to go through this Laplacian eigenmaps. Belkin and Nyogi in 2002 published a very nice paper on it. Suffice it to say that you're going to find coordinates yi and yj in some lower dimensional space, maybe two dimensions to visualize, such that you basically preserve distance in the ontological space. Now, of course, where we've pruned neighbors if their expression profiles are too dissimilar. Okay? So this embedding has been applied to the particular data set that's out there called the Young data set by looking at, in this case, in vitro tuberculosis infection of macrophage cells that then are assayed using microarrays and RT-PCR to produce that gene map, that heat map I showed you before. And there are eight time points, and they want to basically look at how these dendritic macrophage cells respond after the tuberculin has been introduced. And so here's the data for the control group. Here's the data for the tuberculosis group, again, over time. And so what we're going to be trying to do is determine changes and associate those changes from control to the tuberculin group with functional protein production. Okay, so we're going to take, first of all, a difference between the control and tuberculosis so that we can have a baseline, which is control. And then we're going to embed those expression profiles, those differential expression profiles, into a two-dimensional space using this Laplacian eigenmap embedding. So I'm first going to show you, though, the standard functional PCA embedding, which simply applies a singular value decomposition on a spline basis interpolation over time of those gene expression profiles I showed you in the previous slide. And then afterwards it applies a Gaussian mixture model clustering to try and associate these different genes as hopefully associated with different pathways or different functions. So what you see is this classic concentration of measure here where the Gaussian mixture models have basically, they're trying to match with a two-dimensional domain. They're trying to simultaneously capture clusters which might actually be two dimensions, but there are also clusters that are probably just one dimension. So it's a very heterogeneous space. And if you go and look at, after you've clustered, you wouldn't expect these clusters to be very good, right? Because this cluster is obviously, the centroid isn't even near any particular gene. We can classify how good this clustering is simply by looking at the percentages of each one of these genes in a given cluster that lie in the same location in the cell. And there's over 50% are not co-located. Over 50% of all of the genes in any cluster are not co-located in the cell, which indicates that, again, that gene expression over time, the profiles do not discriminate accurately between genes with different function. On the other hand, if you use this manifold co-embedding that I described, you get a much nicer spread of the of these clusters into well-defined groups. These are four different clusters. You drop to a much lower percentage of impurity, right? So many more of the genes within the cluster groups, labeled green, blue, and turquoise, and so forth, lie close to each other within the cell, which is the sign, of course, the method that we implemented is actually capturing this co-location ontology. And so this just shows some clustering indices. I'm not going to bother dwelling on that. I'm running out of time. But indicating that we have improved performance, not surprisingly, because we're using ontological data, gene ontology data, to condition these clusters. If you just use functional PCA, you get cluster indices for these various pathways have much lower quality than if you use our method, which you can see just comparing these numbers. This is the quality index between 0 and 1 that, again, indicate the purity of each one of these clusters in terms of the number of genes that lie within the same cluster. Right. Okay, so in conclusion, I've described this method which deals with co-embedding of both expression data and functional annotation of genes in terms of their expression under, in this particular case, tuberculosis infection. I've basically described how we do this using Laplacian eigenmaps. It allows us to, if you like, couple the variable selection, clustering, and functional annotation into one package. And as a result, we get improved pathway analysis by doing it this way. So that's all I have to say.
Would you elaborate a little bit on the distances between the geoterms?
Yeah.
Because it seems that you're not using the hierarchical structure of the geoterms.
Well, so yeah. So those distance, we are, let me go back to this equation. So, I skipped over this, partially because there's a typo, but...
that J shouldn't be there. So this distance is defined in terms of the number of GO terms which are common to the two genes and the number of GO terms that are marginals. So that what that's actually doing, if you look at the this graph here, is it's saying if I have two genes and I look at where they lie. So let's say that you have two genes that lie within, this particular organelle and membrane collocation. Well, then you go back and look at the parent, and it's the parent statistics that tell you, that give you this topological mapping. Now, granted, it's only the parents. We don't look up to the grandparents and the great-grandparents and so forth. But we are taking account of topology in that at least first-order sense. Yeah, sure.
Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you. What can you do if you have only a partial knowledge of the ontology?
Which is actually what we have, because
okay.
One can't believe the all published results. And so we don't have, but we would like to have, measures of confidence. In terms of the degree to which the ontology can be relied upon, that doesn't exist yet, right? I think that it's one of the main deficiencies of the functional annotations that we have today, that there is no figure of merit, figure of confidence that one can use that allows you to in a systematic way know what kind of weighting you need to apply to that ontological information in order to balance the uncertainty of ontology versus the uncertainty of gene expression, right? So the answer is not a satisfactory one, unfortunately. I can't give you an upbeat answer there.
A related question. It's very often in pathologies or diseases, the gene expression location may change.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And then how do you, which means that in a way you are going to bias or completely ill-locate a gene through the ontology, which is maybe not the one corresponding to the disease. How do you deal with this?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it's related, of course, to the fact that the ontology really should be a temporal database, and it's not, right? It collapses the entire time course of, you know, functional activation into a summary. So the only way that we account for that is by the fact that the ontological annotation to each one of these genes is not unique. It's not just a one-dimensional quantity. So a gene may belong simultaneously to several locations. To, you know, if the protein production that it's responsible for at two different phases is, say, in the nucleus under one phase and in over the membrane in another phase. But again, the ontology is not rich enough yet to be able to capture that temporal information. If it was, we could obviously do much better. And we could really start talking about pathways which are temporally modulated. Excellent question.
Basically, you know, reflect this temporal change, if the data is temporal, right, to reflect this or add this temporal change into the annotation. So that's probably,
Right. I'd love to agree with you there that we've done that, but we haven't. because we could do that if we computed distance, sort of short time distance over a window between gene expression, but we actually compute the distance over the entire temporal period that's collected. So time again is collapsed. But if we truly had ontological data that was temporally specific, we could develop a much more sophisticated model that would be, you know, frankly more useful. Okay. Yeah. But this is the beginning.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Let's thank Al again.
Thank you.